Welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics Podcast with me, Ken MacDonald. I'm a former Director of Public Prosecutions and a barrister practising at Matrix Chambers in London.
And with me, Tim Owen. I'm also a barrister at Matrix Chambers practising in human rights law, crime and public law.
Well, one of the big questions facing humanity at the moment seems to be the issue of artificial intelligence, what it is, where it's going, what its impact is going to be, not least on the legal profession and how it might be regulated successfully or less successfully without stifling innovation, without stifling its potential benefits to humanity. And we're going to discuss this in a way that I hope is not too technical, but will be, I'm sure, highly illuminating, because we're very fortunate to have with us one of the world's leading experts in this field, Professor Stuart Russell. Stuart was born in Portsmouth in 1962. He attended St. Paul's School in London, where he was first scholar, which I'm assuming means top of the school or top of his form or something very illustrious anyway. He studied physics at Wadham College, Oxford, and took a first class honours degree in 1982, moved to Stanford to complete a PhD in computer science at Stanford University in 1986. After his PhD, he joined the faculty of the University of California at Berkeley as a professor of computer science, and he remains at that university. He now holds the Smith-Sade Chair in Engineering at Berkeley, and he founded and leads the Center for Human-Compatible Artificial Intelligence, also at UC Berkeley, and he's an honorary fellow at Wadham College. In 2012, Stuart was appointed to the Blaise Pascal Chair in Paris, awarded to, quote, internationally acclaimed foreign scientists in all disciplines, as well as the Senior Chair of Excellence at France's National Research Agency. He has been a Vice Chair of the World Economic Forum's Council on AI and Robotics and is currently a member of its Global AI Council. His awards include the National Science Foundation's Presidential Young Investigator Award, the World Technology Award, the Mitchell Prize, and the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence Outstanding Educator Award. He was appointed an OBE in the 2021 Birthday Honours for Services to Artificial Intelligence, and he was the 2021 Reith Lecturer at the BBC. I first met Stuart back in about 2015 or 2016 in his laboratory at Berkeley, and I asked him the rather obvious question whether AI was going to save humanity or destroy it. And he looked at me for a moment, paused, and then said, Ken, I'm going to answer in language you'll understand. The jury is out. And I fear, Stuart, that the jury still remains out, but we're going to explore that a bit in this podcast. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us on Double Jeopardy.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Yes, hi, Stuart. Many thanks for joining us.
So I'd like to start, really, if we could, lawyers always like to do this, by defining our terms, Stuart. You have indeed said on a number of occasions that artificial general intelligence or general purpose artificial intelligence, it is something that could herald, as you put it in your Reith lecture, a golden age for humanity, or alternatively could have disastrous consequences for humanity. And I think at the moment you think we're potentially on the latter path rather than the former. Could you say a little bit, first of all, please, about what general purpose artificial intelligence is and what you think are the primary risks associated with the way we're developing it at the moment and the way we're perhaps failing to regulate it at the moment?
Sure. So let me begin by saying what artificial intelligence is. And obviously it's about making machines intelligent. And what does that mean? Well, so we focus in AI, first of all, on the behavior from an external point of view. What does the system do? And do its actions actually help to achieve its objectives? And to the extent that they do, we would describe the system as intelligent. General purpose intelligence would be AI systems that can actually succeed at more or less any task. So when we, for example, build a chess program, that's a program specifically aimed at one particular task. And even though it may beat the world chess champion, it can't play noughts and crosses to save its life. Whereas a general purpose AI system, you know, even if it had never heard of noughts and crosses, you should be able to explain what it is, and then it would be extremely good at it. Same with any other task. So it should be able to quickly learn to be a bricklayer or a poet or a, you know, fighter pilot or any other thing that humans can do.
And it learns from the data that's put into it.
It may learn from experience, but it may also learn from explanation. So if I wanted it to be a bricklayer, I might explain what it is to lay bricks and what you're supposed to do. But it would probably need to practice in order to learn something about the precise consistency of mortar and how long to leave it before you put the next layer of bricks in, and how exactly do you wiggle the bricks to get them all lined up properly, and so on. But if it's an intelligent system, you'd expect it to become an expert bricklayer very quickly, you know, more quickly than any human being.
You've drawn a distinction, I've seen some of the talks you've given, and you've drawn a distinction between knowing something and understanding something. Can you just explain a bit about that in terms of the limitations on AI, even general purpose AI?
So the word understanding usually triggers in people's minds some notion of subjective experience, having that real feeling that you get something. And we don't have any way of saying whether AI systems have that type of understanding where they subjectively experience, what it's like. Do you understand what it's like to lose a parent? Well, AI systems probably don't.
You say probably. Is there a doubt there? I mean, why would there be a doubt?
On the question of subjective experience, we have no scientific theory whatsoever. We don't know why humans have subjective experience. In fact, we don't know that humans have subjective experience except for our own subjective experience. And as Alan Turing mentioned in his 1950 paper, it's a polite convention that we ascribe subjective experience to other human beings. But we don't have a way of telling, and we certainly don't have a way of telling for machines. I think most people assume, at least for the time being, that they're not having subjective experience. I don't experience a pang of guilt when I turn my laptop off, for example. But that may change, and that's a question of really how we interpret the machine's behavior, and it might just change our perceptions, even in the absence of any scientific understanding.
I think you described the risk, the sort of limitation in feeling and the risk associated with that very well in an article that was published in the Boston Globe, and I think also in the Guardian. And you were talking about ChatGPT and GPT-4, its successor. In other words, large language models. And you said this: they're trained using tens of trillions of words of text, as much as all the books humanity has produced, to imitate human linguistic behavior. They result from billions of trillions of small random perturbations in the training process. They're not designed or programmed in any meaningful sense. They do not follow rules. Like chess programs, they may be pursuing objectives, but we have no idea what those objectives are. And you express, I think, the limitation of our approach to policing this, if policing is the right word, in this way. You say, to get large language models to behave themselves, which we obviously need to, OpenAI employs thousands of human trainers to say the equivalent of bad dog every time the systems misbehave. And misbehave they still do, you say, advising on ways to commit suicide or build biological weapons, practicing law and medicine without a license, and committing dozens of other categories of transgressions. Large language models are also notorious for hallucinating, generating completely false answers, often supported by fictitious citations, because their training has no connection to an outside world and the truth of assertions about it. Now, there's a whole encyclopedia of risk alluded to in those short paragraphs, Stuart, from our point of view as human beings.
Yes, and I should say ChatGPT and its successors do not constitute the kind of general purpose AI that I described at the beginning. ChatGPT can't learn to be a particularly good bricklayer. There are versions of it. There's a Gemini project at Google DeepMind that is trying to extend this to the physical world. But none of these systems can really come up with and execute long-term plans that work successfully in the real world. So there are these gaps that still have to be filled in research. But as those gaps are filled, we then start to face this real problem. How do we ensure that the way the system behaves is actually going to be beneficial to us? How do we ensure that it's not pursuing some objective that turns out to be catastrophic?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm very interested in that question. I want to come on in a minute to ask you in the context of what the UK is doing in terms of the regulatory regime. But can we just go back to Alan Turing, who you mentioned earlier on? And it's my question is perhaps to do with the pace of development, because in your Reith lecture, you mentioned that in 1936, as long ago as that, Turing identified two new kinds of mathematical objects, that's machines and programs. And you said that 8 of the 10 most valuable companies in the world were created by those two mathematical objects. And you referred to Turing's 1950 paper, Machinery, Computing and Intelligence, as introducing the core principles of AI. And I was astonished to read that it was as long ago as that that these principles were being identified. And of course, we're now 75 years on, and it seems to people like me, not non-scientists, that it's only in the last 10 or 15 years that AI has really become a major factor in our day-to-day lives. And so I suppose my real question is, What happened between Turing's 1950 paper, the identification of these things, and 50 years in between?
So lots of things happened. If we start working back from the present, you know, last year, two new kinds of AI systems, the image generation systems like DALL-E and the language models like ChatGPT, suddenly burst into the public consciousness. And that really was a revolution in public awareness of AI, because they may not have been aware of it, but most people were using AI all the time. I mean, every time you use a search engine, there's lots of AI going on behind the scenes to make sure that the results you get are actually the ones that you want. Every time you go on a shopping website, there are AI algorithms choosing what is recommended. Every time you use social media, there are AI algorithms choosing, you know, what video comes up on YouTube, for example, or what's in your newsfeed. So all of that is AI, and it's been building slowly, but surely over many decades. I mean, these are mostly algorithms that have been around for decades. What's different is that suddenly you could interact directly with the AI system. And that hasn't been possible because previously to interact with AI systems, except in very narrow areas like chess programs and so on, where the rules are very circumscribed, you would have to know how to provide the formal inputs that the system would require. So mathematicians were using AI-based theorem proving assistance for quite a few decades, but that's not something that the general public would be able to use. It's almost like learning how to write computer programs.
You gave a lecture at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, I think, was it 10 years ago?
Yes.
Yeah, and you said, again, you referred to this in your Reith lecture, that success, meaning success in the development of general purpose artificial intelligence, would be the biggest event in human history, and perhaps the last event in human history, which is quite a dystopian, apocalyptic prediction. And again, we'll come on to the regulatory aspects of it and how you can actually construct a regulatory regime. But I mean, is your basic fear about the risks involved in this area that you've devoted your life to, is it still the same?
Yes, and I would say it's starting to feel more urgent than it did in 2013. But I should say, this is not a new point. I mean, Alan Turing in 1951.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah. I mean, can I just read what he said, Stuart? It seems probable that once the machine thinking method had started, it would not take long to outstrip our feeble powers. At some stage, therefore, we should have to expect the machines to take control. Alan Turing, 1951.
So he was actually basing that on a book from the 1860s by Samuel Butler. And in Samuel Butler's book, there's a civilization that has hitherto been undiscovered that has banished machines altogether because they realized that once you went down that path of developing more and more capable machinery, you would end up with machines that are superior to humans, and then we would become their slaves if we're lucky. So that was 1862 or something like that. And so this is not a new idea at all. For most of history, it was entirely hypothetical. You know, some people have drawn analogies between these kind of superior intelligent machines and corporations. So you can view a corporation as a type of machine that has human components, but it's pursuing this fixed objective of discounted quarterly profit streams and operates in a fairly algorithmic fashion with, you know, committees and hierarchy of control, so on and so forth. And because the objective is actually not aligned with the general well-being of the human race, we have things like disastrous climate change as a result. So you might point to the fossil fuel industry as a machine that has already taken over the world.
In about from about 2015, for a few years, I was working with the two of the founders of DeepMind, now Google DeepMind, Demis Hassabis and Mustafa Seliman. And Mustafa came to see me in Oxford, and he said to me, "I'm going to tell you what we're doing and what we think might happen. And for the first 20 minutes, you'll think I'm mad, but keep listening." And I did think he was mad, but I kept listening, and I realized he wasn't mad. And he was expressing exactly these fears, the danger of the work they were doing and the need for it to be properly regulated. And we worked for some time on creating a sort of ethical framework governing the use to which the technology could be put. And it was extraordinarily difficult and complex. But you've identified, and you summarize it very clearly in a TED talk you gave, you've identified what is necessary, and you've suggested that what we need is provably beneficial AI, and there are three key components. The first is purely altruistic robots. We can understand that. The second, with uncertain objectives, and I want to come back to that. And the third, that learn, so altruistic robots with uncertain objectives that learn by observing all humans. Now, one can understand one and three, but two sounds a little counterintuitive. Why on earth would we want them to have uncertain objectives? Most people would think, and I thought before I started reading your various papers, of course we'd want them to have certain objectives, but it turns out that's a trap, and the objectives have to be uncertain. Could you just explain that for our audience?
Yeah, so we call this the King Midas problem. So King Midas famously said, "Everything I touch should turn to gold." So that was the objective that he stated. And then the gods, here playing the role of the AI system, go ahead and make that happen. And then, of course, he tries to eat something and it turns to gold before he can eat it. He tries to drink something and that turns to gold. You know, puts his hand on his daughter's shoulder for consolation and she turns to gold. So it's a complete disaster. And so this idea that we can specify objectives completely and correctly, and that's a prerequisite for the standard way of doing AI, that idea is simply false. We cannot do it. Except in these very artificial circumstances like chess, where the objective of checkmate is actually built into what it means to play chess. So we don't have to argue about it. But in the real world, you know, even for something like a self-driving car, it turns out to be extremely difficult to specify, for example, how the car should trade off safety with making progress towards the destination and legality and so on. So right now, they follow the law very strictly and annoy everybody else on the roads. They're not really making that trade-off right either. And if you had really capable systems that have within the scope of what they can achieve, any large-scale change to the world, then you're facing almost certain catastrophe. So this idea of uncertainty is, let me put it this way. So the what altruistic means is its only objective is to further human interests. The uncertainty means it knows that it doesn't know exactly what those interests are. And so what that uncertainty does is several things. First of all, it provides the machine with an incentive to learn more about what our interests are, because that's what it's got to achieve. And it can do that by observing us, by talking with us, by reading all the stuff we've written. So there are many, many sources of information about what we want the future to be like. But of course, you know, we don't even know ourselves. So there's always going to be residual uncertainty. But it also means that they're going to defer to human instructions. And in the extreme case, if we want to switch them off because there's something that they're about to do that we don't like, even if they don't know which of the things we don't like, they want to be switched off because they don't want to do it, because that wouldn't further our interests. And so this is something that, you know, I can say this in words, but we can also turn it into a mathematical theorem.
Against that background or that answer, Stuart, can we move to this question of regulation? I've been looking at the government's white paper or consultation paper published earlier this year, a pro-innovation approach to AI. But can I set the scene for the question I want to ask you about the possibility of addressing the question which you have effectively been concerned about for the last decade, which is the Turing issue. How do we retain power over entities more powerful than us forever? And you refer to the standard model definition of AI as machines are intelligent to the extent that their actions can be expected to achieve their objectives. You say that's the source of the problem, because we need to specify the objectives, and we've got the King Midas problem. And you say we can't specify objectives correctly because we can't write down what it is the human race wants the future to be like. And we want AI systems, as you say, to be beneficial. And so you suggest this redefinition, that machines are beneficial to the extent that their actions can be expected to achieve our objectives. And so that led me to think, well, okay, if you're drafting an act of parliament or a regulatory regime, how do you translate that principle into something that's effective but doesn't destroy innovation? And you refer to something which I would like you perhaps to explain a bit more, which is the assistance game solver as the answer to the control problem. And so can we just, before I ask you about the regulatory regime, can you just say a little bit more about this mathematical formula of assistance game solving and how that's relevant?
Yeah, so the assistance game is the mathematical formulation of the three principles. And so it's formulated in game theory. Game theory is just the branch of economics that deals with decisions when there is more than one decision maker involved. And so here the decision makers are AI system and the human being. And of course, there could be obviously many human beings and also many AI systems. And so in the assistance game, the humans are the ones who have a payoff function. They care what the future is like. And the AI's payoff is exactly whatever the human's payoff is, right? Because it wants to further human interests. So it's paid off to the extent that the humans are happy with what happens. And then, but it starts out not knowing what that payoff function is. So as the game itself unfolds, there are interactions between the human and the machine. And in those interactions, the machine learns more about what the human wants by seeing what decisions does the human make. And in fact, the human has an incentive to teach the machine. So the human will do teaching actions to help the machine understand what the human wants. Just like, you know, if you had someone come into your house to repaint your kitchen, they don't know what you want exactly. So you might have a whole interaction with them about, well, what color should it be? And do we want glossy or matte? Do you want to paint this bit or should I do some white trim? And you go through that whole interaction. And we have many, many examples. Restaurants are another good example where The chef doesn't know what the customer wants, and you have a protocol for information to flow from the customer to the chef called a menu, and that's how the chef learns how to further the customer's interest. And so this is not something that's completely unfamiliar, but it's a general framework that encompasses all of those things.
And it's a framework that is essentially achieves your three components.
Yeah. So if we can do it, so if we can actually build AI systems that instantiate this framework that are assistance game solvers, then they should have all these desirable properties. They will defer to us. They will be cautious in how they behave. They'll allow themselves to be switched off, and in they're guaranteed to be helpful.
I don't know if you've. I'm sure you have read the government's white paper, this pro-innovation approach to AI.
Yep.
And I read through it, having read about assistance game solving, and surprisingly, there's no reference to assistance game solving in the government's approach to how it's going to, as it intends to do, to create clarity and coherence, it says, to the AI regulatory landscape. This regime is designed to make responsible innovation easier. It will strengthen the UK's position as a global leader in AI, harness AI's ability to drive growth and prosperity, and increase public trust in its use. And it, paragraph 10 of the paper sets out the five principles to guide and inform the responsible development and use of AI in all sectors. And I think these are OECD principles as well. Safety, security, and robustness, principle one. Appropriate transparency and explainability. Fairness, accountability, and governance. And contestability and redress. Now, those are all quite sort of broad principles, which you could put in an act of parliament, or you could put in a sort of non-statutory guidance that's supposed to inspire and regulate the industry. But it doesn't seem to me that the kind of level of risk and the Turing fear is one that the government is really addressing here. It's more looking at how to make the UK the leading sort of centre to develop AI, but without interfering with the innovative entrepreneurial spirit. Is that fair?
I think that's fair as of the date of that document.
That's March this year.
Yeah. So I think the government has really moved very quickly. I won't use the phrase U-turn or anything like that, but it has moved very quickly to actually improve its understanding of the situation. I think it got a lot of negative feedback when that paper was published. And if you look at the agenda for the upcoming Global AI Summit, the government...
Which is next week, I think, isn't it? Next 2 weeks?
It's the 1st of November. Oh. And the agenda is really very much focused on the kinds of risks that we've been discussing.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
And so the first principle that was named in the white paper, which I think comes from principle 1.4 of the OECD principles, safety, security, robustness, that does encompass these risks. And if you take it seriously, then you'd have to say none of the current generation of AI systems satisfy these requirements. They also don't satisfy explainability because they can't explain themselves and we have no idea what they're doing. So they're not contestable either. So there's really, already in those principles, there's a massive gap between what the industry knows how to do and what any reasonable interpretation of those rules would require. And I think that's actually a good thing, because if we turn this into hard law, real regulations that say you have to demonstrate to the regulator before you put your system in the market that it has these desirable properties. And if you can't do that, then it doesn't get to go into the market. So the same way we do with nuclear power, that nuclear power people have to demonstrate to the regulator that their system has a mean time to failure of 10 million years. And if they can't, then they can't build the station. And it's as simple as that. And the regulations don't say how you should build nuclear power stations. So it's not surprising that the AI regulations don't say how you should build AI systems. They just say, whatever you do, you show us that they have these desirable properties. You know, that's true of, you know, sandwiches. They don't tell you how to make sandwiches. They just say, sandwiches have got to not kill people with food poisoning, right? And they've got to, you know, they've got to be healthy. They have to have, you know, healthy certified ingredients and so on.
I mean, this is the point, isn't it? That people balk at the idea of legislation because they fear it would be horrendously complex and unintelligible, as though lots of our legislation isn't already, frankly, although I'm not saying it should be emulated. But the reality is that the decision-making on the ground is devolved. And in this case, one would hope it would be devolved to a highly sophisticated regulator who would be looking for reassurance in just the way that you've described. I'm sure nuclear power is fearsomely complex. I'm sure putting together satellite launches is fearsomely complex. But it's a question of those who are doing the design and constructing being able to reassure a regulator. And I guess that's how this would work. We've been looking at this international conference that is being convened, I think, to its credit by the government. I wanted to raise the question of China and the extent to which you feel that cooperation against nations, genuine cooperation, will be possible and genuine standards across nations will be possible. Rather counterintuitively, I think China has some of the strongest AI regulation in the world as we speak, and that may be because it's concerned about the position of the Chinese Communist Party and doesn't want it to be threatened by some geek sitting in a bedroom in Shanghai. But how do you see China in this debate? Where is China? Is it acting purely from self-interest, or is it interested in a genuine international discourse and genuine international regulation in this area?
Well, I can't speak for the Politburo or Xi Jinping himself, but
that's a surprise, Stuart.
the meetings that I've had in China have been very positive, and there's definitely a willingness to participate cooperatively because they recognize that this is a threat to everybody. You know, even if Andorra produces an unsafe superintelligent AI system, that's still curtains for the entire world. And so there's a strong interest in ensuring that this is a global cooperative process of both regulation and doing the research on the safety side, because what we lack right now, I mentioned that we have a lot of very unsafe systems that appear to be quite capable. What we don't have is a lot of safe systems that are also capable. So we have to do that safety research so that the AI industry can move forward. But we also have to be, I think, quite hard-nosed and say, you know, just because it's difficult for you to meet the regulation does not mean we're going to waive the regulation.
Could I come back, Stuart, though? I'm the parliamentary draftsman who's been given the task against these broad principles of drafting an act of parliament and then a statutory instrument with all the other sort of fine detail. The point at the moment, and this is the Ada Lovelace Institute have done a very good paper criticising the current state of affairs in Britain. They say there's currently no holistic body of law governing the development, deployment or use of AI in the UK. Instead, developers, deployers and users abide by the existing fragmented network of rules under the UK regulatory ecosystem. This includes horizontal cross-cutting frameworks such as human rights law, the equality laws, data protection laws, privacy, and then some vertical domain-specific regulation, to use the jargon, such as the regime for medical devices. And so the question then is, how could you create a bespoke law that is focusing on controlling the objectives that are legitimate objectives to program into machines to avoid the King Midas problem and to avoid the, wipe out the world with autonomous weapon problem? I suppose my thinking is this. I mean, there's already the law, we've got the criminal law to prosecute anyone who plans mass murder, whether they're using AI or, a knife. And so we've got the equality laws, we've got the data protection laws, as they say, there are all these other cross-cutting legal frameworks which can deal with individual bad actors. My question is, is it possible? I struggle to understand how you would deal with the problem you've identified, which is controlling objectives without stifling the ability to be innovative. Because how do you know what the objectives are that are any one time to be defined by statute as legitimate or acceptable?
Right. So I'm not proposing that one should do that. If we succeed in developing this technology of assistance game solvers to the point where they are very capable and very useful, then we could basically offer that as a template and say, you know, your systems have got to be designed according to this template or some other template that has equally desirable theoretical properties. But at the moment, that's unrealistic. And so what I think is the right approach at the moment, in addition to setting up a knowledgeable regulator that can do all the nitty-gritty work, is to draw some red lines and say, here are behaviors that if your system exhibits them after deployment, it's immediately removed from the market, along with every copy, which then puts a much bigger obligation actually on the open source providers, because there might be tens of thousands of copies of their systems out there. And similarly, you have to demonstrate to the regulator that your system isn't going to cross those red lines. Some examples of red lines, it's more a matter of political feasibility, I think. For example, a system should not replicate itself. A system should not break into another computer system. A system should not advise terrorists on how to build biological weapons.
But my point is there are already laws in place that would make all of that behavior unlawful. The question is...
Actually, no, there aren't.
Well,
you're the legal expert, but you know, the OpenAI systems like ChatGPT advise people on building biological weapons all the time. And they haven't gone to jail. So obviously,
that's interesting, actually. But I mean, obviously, it is a crime to incite a terrorist act or to conspire or to, if you have the right intention.
Right, but you can't put the AI system in jail, and the law applies to humans. You know, we have the same problem with copyright law.
Yeah,
you can only copyright something if it's made by humans. So all these AI systems are busy drawing pictures and writing books and. It can't be copyrighted.
I mean, there's a vast amount of obviously unlawful behavior, incitement and encouragement to crime on the internet. That's absolutely right. And it's very, very difficult to control because it's so spread out and so pervasive. It might be easier, actually, to approach the regulatory problem on the basis that you control the machine that's enabling all of that at its point of manufacture, licensing and release, rather than trying to control the behavior after the machine has been released. And you're proposing the former rather than the latter, Stuart. You're saying that machines should be designed in such a way that they can't do these things. And that's an easier issue for law enforcement to deal with than a situation where these machines have been built and there are thousands of people out there using the machines to do this kind of stuff, which is enabled by the machine. So I think actually the at-base approach to regulation is far more sensible than waiting for the thing to be put out on the market and then used by the bad actors.
I think so. I mean, obviously, you probably want both because the process of testing and demonstrating to the regulator that your system is going to behave itself is a difficult one. And if you look at, you know, for example, Fukushima... Right, the design. There's nothing wrong with the design of the plant per se. It's just they just didn't expect a 33-foot tsunami wave that topped the protective wall and then swamped the system and caused a meltdown. So things happen in the real world, and you need to be able to respond to that. So this actually puts significant burdens on the developers that they have to be able to switch their system off, and If you do an open source approach where now there's tens of thousands of the systems out there, they have to be able to switch all of them off. Well, that's quite an obligation.
Can I come to one other issue, which I think could become very widespread and is related to some of the stuff that we've been talking about, and that's intellectual property. So I was having dinner a few weeks ago with someone who's a musician, a singer and a composer and quite well known. And he started talking about AI, and he pulled out his phone and got onto ChatGPT and said to it, write a song in the style of, and then he gave his own name. And it came out with a, you know, pretty, well, certainly sounded like him, the same sort of music, good, you know, plausible, convincing. And he said this sort of stuff is starting to happen, and we have no kind of recourse. And it's essentially using our intellectual property. And for musicians, and I'm sure for all sorts of other categories of workers, this is potentially a nightmare. I think when we were discussing this earlier, Stuart, you said you think there's a court case going on about this in the States at the moment.
There are several, both by, I think, musicians, artists, and authors. I think George Martin, who wrote Game of Thrones,
suing.
And the issue is that, you know, there are laws around fair use, and you can reproduce a quotation or maybe a paragraph, if you're lucky, from a book without having to get permission and pay royalties. But anything more than that, you know, they can not grant permission, or they can impose some royalty fee. But this is a different type of use. It's not that they're copying it and then obtaining commercial advantage by reproducing that copy. They're ingesting it. And it would be hard to argue that, you know, artists are not allowed to visit museums, see other people's paintings. And novelists are not allowed to read any books while they're growing up. And, you know, I think everyone's writing style and painting style does have derivative elements. I think the issue is people put their stuff online for certain purposes, and this was not one of them. I suspect, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I suspect the judgment in these cases will just come down to some accidents of the way the law is written. Because the laws weren't written with the intent of covering this kind of case at all. And this is what happened with copyright. It's just an accident of copyright law that only humans can own a copyright. But if these cases fail, then legislators will step in, say, no, we do need to protect this, because it's not just that it can write a song in that style. But any time I want to listen to a song that sounds like, you know, a given artist, it can write a new one.
Stuart, can we end, since we're on the subject of litigation, can we just end with what hopefully will be a reassuring note for our legal listeners, and the AI won't get rid of lawyers? I mean, our legal system, as you know, operates in the criminal field on the basis of trial by jury, and we choose to have 12 random people decide questions of guilt and innocence. And you could say that the system is extremely inefficient and not necessarily the best way of convicting the guilty or acquitting the innocent. And so the question is, could AI ever have a role to play? Obviously, it'd be a matter of political choice. But my instinctive reaction would be, well, on the basis that machines don't have an IQ and machines don't have empathy, they can't assess credibility, there are limitations on what even general purpose AI can achieve in terms of substituting the human reality. Whether you look at criminal trials and the 12 random people deciding questions of guilt or innocence, or a judge who will also have to look at a witness, hear the evidence, assess credibility and so on before determining the outcome of a civil trial. I mean, I'm hoping you're going to say, oh, there's no way that that general purpose AI is ever going to be a substitute for that process.
Actually, no, well, I'm not going to say that. And in some ways, you know, AI is already inching its way up the food chain, you know, so fingerprint matching systems, face recognition systems, the systems that, the radar detectors that speeding, you know, there's technology that is making decisions at various levels already.
But that's evidence. That's improving the gathering of evidence to prove guilt, for example.
Yeah,
identification.
It's got to the point, I think, where in fact it is a judgment of guilt In the case of speeding, for example, you'd have to have a pretty good argument to get out of a speeding ticket like that. But there are things that AI systems can do to help with some of the reasoning tasks in criminal trials that are extremely difficult for humans. So, in fact, I just gave a talk at the Royal Society. They had Science in the Interests of Justice. A lot of very senior judges and lawyers and some scientists talking about what science can provide. And so I talked about the probability of identity, where you observe two people, two cars, two telephones, whatever it might be, and are they in fact the same person, same car, or the same telephone? And one might be a photograph, another one might be a DNA sample. And it turns out to be very difficult for humans to actually do that correctly. But there is a way. We have built AI systems that do that reasoning correctly, even in extremely complex cases.
But that's not the same thing as assessing demeanor and credibility.
This is true. But there are systems that do that fairly well. Judging whether people are lying actually is very difficult for most people. I think they're pretty much at chance. And Paul Ekman, who's a friend of mine, a very famous psychologist, so he did lots of studies, and he found that the only people who could tell whether someone was lying were people who were in the Secret Service.
Yeah, hopefully not after torture. I think this highlights something important, actually, which is the way many people feel about AI in a kind of broad instinctual sense, which is that people think there's something about the human gut. There's something in the human gut that can never be replicated by a machine. So, you know, there's something finally, when you've gone through all the reasoning and when you've looked at all the evidence, there's something there in the human stomach that prods you in one direction rather
than another. Digestion.
Okay. And don't be cynical, Stuart.
But it also provides this legitimacy.
Hang on. I wanted to give an example.
Yeah.
During the Falklands War, the British sank an Argentinian troop carrier called the Belgrano, and there were several hundred, maybe even thousands of sailors drowned. At the time, the government, the Prime Minister herself, I think, said that the Belgrano had been sailing towards the conflict zone at the time it was sunk. And in fact, the truth was that the ship had been sailing away from the conflict zone. And a couple of years later, a civil servant called Clive Ponting leaked that fact to the press. And he was unmasked and prosecuted at the Old Bailey. And Bruce Loughlin, his defence counsel, famously in his closing speech said to the jury, members of the jury, if you convict this man, God help us, because no one else will. A sort of famous Old Bailey peroration, which did the trick. That's the point, in a way. What happened was that the jury acquitted Clive Ponting, although the evidence against him was overwhelming, and they acquitted him because they disapproved, I assume, of what the government had done. Now, there's some controversy in criminal law circles about whether a jury has the right to do that or not, but I think most people believe it does. That's the sort of area in which people feel, rightly or wrongly, and you may say wrongly, that AI would be deficient, that Clive Ponting would have been convicted because he committed the offence and the evidence was overwhelming.
Yeah, I think that would be an area where I wouldn't expect AI systems to have that level of judgment for a long, long time. I think it's sort of describing a kind of natural justice, that we have a sense that he acted for noble reasons, and in the long run, it would be better that he not be prosecuted.
And that's the human gut.
So I think that's a good example.
And that's all. And it goes back to your point. It's up to human beings, and you know, it's a political decision, societal decision, to decide what kind of future they want. And so, do you want to retain a system which may be imperfect, may be inefficient, but it carries with it legitimacy and acceptability that no AI system would ever achieve?
Yeah, I think the likely development is that AI systems will advise on how to interpret the evidence, the reasoning processes, how the evidence fits the law, what the precedents are. But I think for the foreseeable future, they'll be a human judge, and in most cases, a human jury, who actually make the decision. But I think it could prevent some miscarriages of justice where juries are swayed by very prejudicial information.
That's the counter position.
And those happen in both directions.
Well, look, Stuart, that's been really a fascinating and educative discussion, I could say. We haven't touched on the appalling question of autonomous weapons, which I've heard you speak about. Indeed, you gave evidence to a parliamentary committee that I sat on about autonomous weapons. That's an episode in itself, which we may ask you to come back and discuss at some future time if you're able to. But it's also a subject which I think is always guaranteed to give our listeners nightmares. So we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you very much for your time, Stuart. It's very good to see you again.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you, Tim.
Yes, thank you so much, Stuart. You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Ken MacDonald and with me, Tim Owen. If you've enjoyed this episode, please spread the word, tell your friends, follow us, and if you feel like it, give us a review, hopefully a good one, but we'll accept all quality, all types of reviews. We will be back with you in a couple of weeks. Our editor is Billy Lawrence, and as ever, our social media advisor is Jess Jones. We'll see you soon.